Welcome to Bloomberg Business Week on Voice Corps. I'm your volunteer reader, Teresa Darnell. Today, I will read from the November 7, 2022 issue. We'll start in business with, "This flameout shouldn't have been a surprise. The Yeezy shoe collaboration was incredibly lucrative, but partners Adidas and rapper Yee have been bickering for years." From the beginning, there were plenty of warning signs that Adidas AG's collaboration with the rapper Yee was destined for a debacle. But for anyone still unsure of the trajectory, the wake-up call came on the morning of May 3, 2018. Kanye West, as he was then called, had just suggested to celebrity gossip site TMZ's newsroom that black people in America had made a choice to remain in slavery for 400 years. Amid the outcry that followed, Adidas's shares plunged. Calls for boycotting its sneakers grew, and Chief Executive Officer Casper Rorsted appeared to do all he could to avoid tackling the subject head-on. In a Bloomberg TV interview that day to discuss Adidas's recent earnings, Rorsted said he wouldn't speculate about every statement from all of his company's external partners. "He's been a fantastic creator," Rorsted said, "and that's where I'm going to leave it." Except Rorsted couldn't leave it at that, not for a minute of TV time, much less for the 4 years leading up to this fall. Had there been any talk at Adidas within the past 24 hours, a TV anchor wanted to know, about cutting ties with rapper and designer? "No," Rorsted curtly responded. On October 25, Adidas finally did sever ties with Yee, weeks after Gap Inc. did so, and days after a similar move by Kering SA's luxury fashion line, Balenciaga. The divorce was particularly significant for Yee because the deal had been his longest-running and most profitable corporate partnership. But it also could have major financial implications for Adidas, which had scored a huge win with the Yeezy line of sneakers and streetwear. The styles inspired by the rapper and social media star helped the company, long a leader in footwear and gear for sports such as soccer, attract a young, hip international clientele that cares more about Instagram posts than instant replays. That cachet and the premium pricing it allowed has paid off. Morgan Stanley analyst Eduardo Aubin estimates that the Yeezy line has been generating $1.8 billion in annual sales, about 8% of Adidas's total revenue and more than 40% of the company's profits. Adidas had appeared to resist calls to end the relationship in the face of Yee's growing string of controversies, which culminated with a spate of anti-Semitic remarks in October on podcasts and social media. Only when global calls to terminate the partnership reached seemingly unbearable levels did Adidas finally announce the split. Within Adidas, there are mixed feelings about the slow reaction. Some of the company's top executive hesitated because they first wanted to obtain opinions from outside law firms in the U.S. They worried that if Adidas went ahead with the termination of the Yee partnership, it might be deemed an obstruction of an ongoing court mediation process, according to people with knowledge of the matter. Still others disagreed with that stance, feeling that Yee's behavior had become so offensive that it merited immediate cutting ties. Outside the company, the delay left the public to draw its own conclusions about Adidas's motivations. Ultimately, the company on October 25 released a statement denouncing Yee's actions as unacceptable, hateful, and dangerous, adding that they violated the company's values of diversity and inclusion, mutual respect, and fairness. Beyond that, Adidas has stayed silent, saying it will fill in more details of the Yeezy breakup and the future of the partnership's shoe designs when it delivers quarterly earnings on November 9. Adidas declined to comment for this story. What was not in the press release is what they are going to do next and how they could learn from this, says Lauren Campier, Managing Director and Head of Stewardship and Engagement at Boston Common Asset Management. Frankly, this is a misstep from the company. To understand why Adidas might have waited weeks to renounce Yee's unacceptable behavior, it helps to recall just how far behind Nike, Inc. it had fallen in the decades since basketball's Michael Jordan soared to global fame in the 1980s and 90s. Rorsted's predecessor, Herbert Hainer, set his sights on closing that gap in the 2000s, at first by spending $3.8 billion to acquire Reebok. When that strategy failed, Hainer shook up his brand management and promoted a young executive named Eric Leitich in 2014. Leitich led a push for higher profit outside partners, tying Adidas to non-athlete celebrities such as Pharrell Williams, Beyoncé, and Yee. Even from the start, Adidas executives were warned that working with Yee could be miserable. Nonetheless, they expanded the Yeezy product line in 2016 with an agreement calling for footwear, apparel, and accessories, along with Yeezy-focused retail stores. The effort would be led by a dedicated Adidas team based at the company's North American headquarters in Portland, Oregon. While many hoped Leitich would take over as CEO, Adidas replaced Hainer in 2016 with Rorsted, a tech industry veteran and darling of the German corporate world, who posted record profits during his stint as CEO of soapmaker Henkel. Rorsted's initial years at Adidas were golden. The share price soared thanks to fast-selling lifestyle sneakers like the Stan Smith and Superstar shoes, as well as the high-priced red-hot Yeezy kicks. He appeared to be generally happy with the arrangement, too, and he was an inspiring figure to many of the young designers working on the Yeezy brand. For a while, many of these 20-somethings were willing to put up with Yee's round-the-clock demands and sometimes unprofessional behavior, according to an Adidas employee who spoke on the condition of anonymity. Beneath the surface, there were signs of trouble. Even Adidas workers who admired Yee began to sour on him by 2018 when the rapper donned a Make America Great Again hat signed by Donald Trump and then made his screed on slavery before the TMZ newsroom. That same year, Yee moved with his then-wife Kim Kardashian and their kids to a ranch in Cody, Wyoming. Some of the 90 or so Yeezy-assigned workers relocated to Wyoming to work at a facility Yee had demanded, which required transporting millions of dollars in machinery. The facility closed within 6 months, the person says. Meanwhile, a series of crises engulfed Adidas headquarters in Herzogenaurach, Germany, starting with Leitich's decision to leave Adidas at the end of 2019. Then came the pandemic, which kicked off a series of other mistakes. First, Rorsted had to apologize and reverse a decision to refuse to pay rent at stores shuttered during the COVID-19 lockdowns. In the U.S., employees began protesting what they believed to be Adidas's tendency to marginalize minorities, particularly black workers. The discord intensified after the murder of George Floyd by a white police officer. Among the complaints was Adidas's continued silence on the growing list of controversial statements from Yee. Rorsted replaced the company's HR chief and went on an employee listening tour, an experience he described as humbling. Adidas faced another blow when it took a stand on cotton sourced in Xinjiang region of China after reports of forced labor. That touched off consumer boycotts in China of Western brands in 2021, which haven't let up. Adidas was left even more reliant on the Yeezy brand to hit its financial targets, and because of the Ukraine war, Adidas has pulled out of Russia, one of the few major countries where it's long beaten Nike. Adidas has issued 2 profit warnings in the past few months. Meanwhile, Yee had already been turning on his partner, demanding a seat on Adidas's supervisory board in 2020, accusing the company in the past year of copying his ideas on Adidas brand products and making personal attacks against Rorsted on social media. In August, with shares down more than half from their peak, Adidas put out a statement that Rorsted would step down early as CEO, clearing the way for someone else to reset the company in 2023. In a fit of schadenfreude, Yee posted and then deleted a fake New York Times front page on Instagram that said, "Casper Rorsted dead at 60. From there, Yee's behavior became more erratic. In early September, he called a Bloomberg reporter at midnight in New York to say he was done with corporations. "They steal my ideas," he said. "It was all collusion, and it was just people trying to control Yee." He soon got suspended from Twitter and Instagram for making anti-Semitic posts that caused a global uproar in early October for hosting a fashion show in Paris where he and models wore shirts that said, "White Lives Matter." Days after that, Adidas finally put its partnership with Yee under review. You're listening to Bloomberg Businessweek on Voice Corps. My name is Teresa Darnell, and I will continue with the article. As Yee drew more negative publicity in the past couple of months, Adidas executives directed Yeezy staffers to keep working on their projects as if nothing was happening, according to a person familiar with the matter. "Many are contractors and fear for their jobs now," the person says. Yee ratcheted up his rhetoric with more anti-Semitic remarks, even saying that Adidas can't fire him despite his antics, and the world began calling on the company to finally end the partnership. Letters came in from the Anti-Defamation League, celebrities took stands on social media, and boycotts of Adidas products picked up again in the U.S. and Europe. Yet for weeks, Adidas declined to respond beyond its statement from October 6, which stated that the partnership is one of the most successful collaborations in our industry's history, but that after repeated efforts to privately resolve the situation, we have taken the decision to place the partnership under review. Adidas didn't stop putting out Yeezy products, however, and by RBC's estimates, it may have generated 100 million euro in Yeezy sales in the first few weeks of October. Plenty of people accuse the company of putting the pursuit of profit in front of principles, especially after a hate group hung a banner over a highway in Los Angeles supporting Yeezy's remarks. Why, the public wondered, had Adidas, a company whose founder was an influential member of the Nazi Party, not cut ties already? "Of course it's money," Doug Ellen, creator of the HBO hit Entourage, told TMZ during an interview in late October, echoing the thoughts of many on social media. What other reason is there? At Adidas' Bavarian headquarters, the matter seemed more complicated. Because of the scale of the Yeezy business, the company's supervisory board needed to weigh in on the decision, according to a person with knowledge of the matter. Meanwhile, Rorsted's management team was waiting for the all-clear signal from two U.S. law firms before acting. Once those opinions were in hand, the top management held an undramatic 2-minute phone call and reached the decision. The press release went out, and in an instant, Yee's billionaire ambitions vanished. Now, Adidas faced a host of questions. Should the company keep selling Yeezy-designed shoes just under the Adidas brand? If so, will consumers still want to buy them? Can Adidas win back customers in China, once its fastest-growing market? And can it ever afford to again become so dependent on a single celebrity? Coming up with answers will ultimately fall to Rorsted's replacement. One question that new leader won't have to answer: what do we do about Yee? This article by Tim Loth and Kim Bashan, with Aaron Kirchfield, Ike Henning, Dasha Offenseva, Albertina Torsley, and Matt Townsend. The bottom line: the end of Adidas' partnership with rapper Yee means its new CEO may struggle to replace its high-margin streetwear business just as its sales in China are under assault. Moving into finance, Meta's flop is the end of Fang. Suddenly, it's clear that big tech stock really can lose, even in the long run. When a big stock dives, as Meta Platforms Inc. did on October 27, dropping almost 25%, investors are often urged to take the long view of its performance. In this case, it hardly helps. If you bought Meta 5 years ago, back when the company was still known as Facebook, you'd be down about 49% in a period when the S&P 500 climbed 45%. Meta has not only erased its gains from the pandemic, which turned social media into an essential technology, but also fallen back to where it was in 2015. Meta isn't just another stock. It was a constituent of the FANG group, investor shorthand for a set of seemingly invincible technology companies. Along with the former Facebook, there were Amazon.com, Apple, Netflix, and Google parent Alphabet. Despite their high valuations, many investors regarded these stocks as safe investments because together they captured where so much of the economy's growth seemed to be, from retailing to entertainment to smartphones, while also commanding strong balance sheets and huge scale to fend off rivals. Today, even though the five stocks still make up over 13% of the market value of the S&P 500, the FANG narrative seems like it's over for good. It's partly a story specific to Meta and increasing skepticism about the chief executive officer Mark Zuckerberg's focus on a still hazy venture called the Metaverse. But it's also a story about how investors have changed their thinking about companies' promises of long-run growth versus the profits they can deliver in the next few quarters or years. Although their declines in the past 12 months aren't as deep as Meta's 72% drop, most of the other FANGs have had a rough time with losses of 40 to 60%. Only Apple Inc. has treaded water. Investors are having a crisis of confidence in growth, says Gene Munster, co-founder of Loop Ventures, a technology investment firm. Big tech investors are embracing the idea that a slowdown could go on for years. Investors' worries about Meta had been building for months. In February, the company suffered the worst single-day valuation drop in U.S. stock market history, erasing more than $251 billion after reporting a drop in Facebook's daily active users. The catalyst for October's tumble was another grim earnings report that showed revenue shrinking. But on top of that, Meta pledged to spend even more on investments in technology hardware to facilitate its shift towards the metaverse, a fledgling immersive digital world. In remarks to analysts, Zuckerberg said the company was doing leading work on the metaverse and that it's often going to take a few versions of each product before they become mainstream. There are still long-term Meta optimists. Munster says if there's a next step for social media beyond mobile phones, just a few companies will be able to dominate, and they're one of them. But the message from shareholders so far has been clear. They don't want to gamble on a next big thing that could take years to pay off, and they want better performance from the core social media brands. That's a common sense approach, but one that hasn't always been applied to big tech, where winners often pivot from one business to the next as growth seems to top out. Netflix was DVDs in the mail, then streaming, then a Hollywood player to rival Walt Disney Co. Amazon was books, then a general retail colossus, plus cloud computing, plus microphones in your house. Facebook was a homepage for college students, then a news feed, and then morphed into mobile media with messaging and photos and video as it became Meta. Facebook proved itself to be a successful company that started with nothing and gained everything, says Marshall Front, chief investment officer at Front Barnett Associates. The question is, can they do it again? There is a lot of skepticism out there. The new wariness may stem partly from how speculative the metaverse is. Meanwhile, the core existing business is slowing down. Meta averaged annual revenue growth of about 42% from 2013 through 2021. This year, the company's sales are projected to shrink by 1%, according to the average of analyst estimates compiled by Bloomberg. There's fierce competition from TikTok and worries about advertisers cutting spending further in a possible recession, which have also weighed on the other social media companies. Snap Inc. is down 79% this year. But investors' loss of faith has been magnified by a jump in interest rates as the Federal Reserve attempts to rein in high inflation. Rising rates can have a particularly strong effect on technology companies because their valuations are based on the promise of bigger profits further into the future. To put a present value on yet-to-be-delivered earnings, number crunchers use interest rates to discount them. The higher the rate, the less future profits are worth today. More generally, when rates are higher, investors may not be willing to pay as much to bet on less certain, more distant profits. Of course, this isn't the first time the tech giants' share prices have come under fire. They tumbled at the onset of the pandemic in 2020, along with everything else, before climbing to new heights when they turned out to be the winners in a lockdown economy. They were also hammered the last time the Fed hiked interest rates in late 2018, which raised fears about a potential recession. That time, too, they rallied back within a few months. You're listening to Bloomberg Businessweek on Voice Corps. My name is Teresa Darnell, and I will continue with the article. 11 months into this sell-off, there are few signs that we're near the end. Inflation is still rampant, and Fed officials have signaled they won't let up until there's been more progress in cooling prices. Valuations are cheaper, but still buyers aren't enticed. Meta traded at more than 50 times projected profits in the years after its 2012 initial public offering. It's now priced at 9 times in a league with Elmer's glue maker, Newell Brands, Inc., and appliance maker, Whirlpool Corp. Things could change as the macroeconomic picture shifts, but for now investors are feeling guarded. Investors have questioned whether the pivot to the metaverse prevented the company from committing even more capital to other areas of growth, says Scott Kessler, global sector lead for technology at investment researcher Third Bridge, speaking of Meta. They made a huge commitment, and perhaps it was too much too soon. This article by Jaron Wittenstein with Jess Menton and Elena Popina. The bottom line, in a time of economic uncertainty and rising interest rates, investors are less willing to write blank checks to Silicon Valley superstars. Next, a big fund faces a real estate crunch. Blackstone's portfolio is a hit with small investors, but it's headed into tougher markets. In just over 5 years, a Blackstone Inc. real estate fund opened to small investors has turned into a $70 billion force. It has swallowed up apartments, suburban homes, dorms, data centers, hotels, and shopping centers. It owns Las Vegas's lavish Bellagio Hotel and Casino, a 76-story New York skyscraper designed by Frank Gehry, and a sprawling Florida complex for interns working at the Walt Disney World Resort. Unlike with many real estate investment trusts, its shares don't trade on exchanges, but fueled by billions of dollars from affluent individuals, Blackstone Real Estate Income Trust, BREIT, has become one of the firm's top profit drivers, expanding property investing in private markets to the masses. Now the money machine is facing its biggest test. Rising interest rates threaten to drag down property values and make cheap debt harder to come by. Even though the BREIT strategy is outperforming stocks, total net returns for its most popular share class were 9.3% in the 9 months ended in September. Inflows are slowing and redemptions are up. Wealth advisors at some banks are growing cautious about client exposure to more illiquid investment. At USB Group AG, some advisors have been shaving their exposure to BREIT after the fund's massive growth made it too big a piece of clients' savings, according to people close to the bank. Staffers at Bank of America Corp. Merrill Lynch have been reviewing clients' portfolios more closely in this market to assess customers' exposure to REITs that don't trade on exchanges, other people say. After years of attracting investors, chasing yield at a time of rock-bottom interest rates, BREIT is coming under new pressure. It has thresholds on how much money investors can take out, meaning if too many people head for the exits, it may have to restrict withdrawals or raise its limits. BREIT was built to weather challenging markets, says Nadim Meji, the head of Blackstone Real Estate Americas, in a statement. Its portfolio is heavily weighted to retail housing and warehouse assets in the U.S. Sun Belt. This is exactly what you want to own in an environment like we are in today, he said. The REIT has piled into $21 billion worth of interest rate swap this year to hedge against higher debt cost. These kinds of swaps have appreciated, helping to buoy the portfolio's overall value. BREIT is operated with substantial liquidity and is structured to never be a forced seller of assets, Mojai says. All of this enabled BREIT to deliver outstanding performance for its investors. President John Gray has put $100 million more of his own money in BREIT since July, as had Chief Executive Officer Steven Schwarzman, a person close to the company says. Still, money flowing into BREIT fell sharply in the third quarter. It took in a net $1.2 billion, down from $7.7 billion the same period a year earlier. A chunk of redemptions has been tied to Asian investors seeking to raise cash in volatile markets. Blackstone set up REIT as a semi-liquid product. It has an overall limit on investors cashing out of 2% of the fund's net asset value each month, or 5% each quarter, though the fund's board has final discretion to raise or lower these thresholds. In June, the most recent date for which monthly data were publicly available, REIT had redemption request of 1.96% of the fund. If it were to limit investors' ability to take out money, it would send ripple effects through the real estate world because of the fund's size and importance as a bellwether for financial markets. It doesn't mean it's bad, wrong, or it's going to happen tomorrow, says Rob Brown, Chief Investment Officer for Integrated Financial Partners, a wealth advisory firm based in Waltham, Massachusetts. But some retail investors may be caught off guard if they assume they could get their money when they want it, he says. REIT's launch in 2017 was seismic for non-traded REITs. That was a corner of finance with tarnished reputation because of high fees, low returns, and an accounting scandal that roiled the then largest sponsor of REITs. The pitch for the trust: a person can take a stake in a swath of properties and collect dividends benefiting from rising real estate values without stock market gyrations. REIT stood out. It let investors come in with as little as $2,500 and stay on as long as they wish, allowing for limited redemption each month. That's in contrast to most buyout funds, which take in money from pensions and big investors and require multi-year commitments. The fund was less expensive than unlisted REITs of its time, but more expensive than mutual funds. REIT was a key factor in Blackstone's bid to become a bigger retail brand, and it sparked a race with KKR & Co., Starwood Capital Group, and others launching similar funds. When markets surged, REIT and other rivals in 2021 and early 2022 were key players in a fundraising boom as action-packed as Peter Davidson's Love Life, analyst with real estate analytics firm Green Street wrote in May, referring to the comedian. When someone puts money into REIT, they invest more than $150,000 on average. The constant flow fueled a hunt for acquisitions that one Blackstone real estate staffer described as unrelenting. REIT was Blackstone's biggest source of profits in the last quarter of 2021. The fund takes in 1.25% of assets and fees and 12.5% of returns. Advisors have won big, too, collecting upfront commissions on some REIT customers. Publicly traded companies have been frequent acquisition targets, including Preferred Apartment Communities, Inc., and college housing landlord American Campus Communities, Inc. REIT kept some 20% of its money in warehouses and logistics centers, betting that e-commerce would buoy rents. Even more money went to residential property, which now accounts for about half of its portfolio. Executives had a thesis that a housing shortage would give property owners leverage to constantly reset rents. This way, the fund could squeeze enough cash to offset inflation, which Gray had predicted in early 2021 would be persistent and stubborn. REIT last year took over Home Partners of America, which now owns 30,000 homes. It was a platform through which Blackstone could say it was giving renters a chance to become homeowners. Blackstone executives concede that landlords across the board will find it harder to raise rents for apartments and single-family homes at the same pace as before, say people close to the firm. But rental rates for warehouses, especially in urban areas, are poised to keep growing strongly as companies look to shore up inventory with supply chain snarled. Rising interest rates have led REIT to lower expectations on what it could earn from exiting its bets, but growing cash flows from renters have supported property values for now. REIT also entered into more swap contracts, which generate cash as long as interest rates stay above a certain level, to counter the effect of rising borrowing cash. A floating-rate mortgage on the Cosmopolitan in Las Vegas, a 3,000-room hotel REIT acquired with partners, has risen to about 7%, up almost 2 percentage points from the loan's initiation in June. A loan on a slice of debt from its takeover of American Campus Communities has also climbed to about 7%. Those increases have been offset by the swaps, say people familiar with the matter. Majee said the firm has locked in or hedged 87% of Breed's debt for the next 6.5 years. Blackstone representatives told One Wealth Management Group recently that Breed will consider more deals as an investor in debt than it has before. That's in contrast to buying the equity in properties, which is riskier in a downturn. Before, interest rates were so low and Breed always had growth. Now it's a bit more difficult, says Kevin Gannon, CEO of real estate investment bank Robert A. Stranger & Co. This article by Don Lim and John Gittleson. The bottom line, Blackstone's real estate fund has brought in smaller investors the company hadn't been able to tap before. Now it has to manage their expectations in a bumpier environment. You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week on VoiceCore. My name is Teresa Darnell, and I will continue in economics with Brazil's economic reality check. Lula has made his way back from a prison cell to the presidency, but his challenges are just beginning. 2 decades after assuming Brazil's presidency the first time around, Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva is once again preparing to take the reins of power in Latin America's biggest economy. After eking out a narrow win in a bitterly fought race against incumbent Bolsonaro, the 77-year-old leftist leader now faces the hurdle of paying for his ambitious pledges and keeping the politically divided country growing in the face of increased global economic and financial headwinds. Lula is returning at a moment of acute political and social tensions in Brazil, where poverty is increasing and the economy hasn't fully recovered from the damage wrought by the COVID-19 pandemic. Revisiting themes from his first stint, he was in office from 2003 to 2010 and subsequently imprisoned after a now-quashed corruption conviction, Lula has vowed to extend beyond the end of this year an augmented program of monthly cash transfers to the poor, exempt more people from income taxes, and boost the minimum wage by more than the rate of inflation. Although these measures will help some, there's also a risk they will stoke price pressures, a global problem that officials are battling hard to contain. He needs to find a way to finance them, too. Brokerage firm XP Inc. has estimated that the measures Lula campaigned on could cost at least 140 billion reais, $27 billion next year. The current budget bill for 2023, which takes into account Bolsonaro's recent tax cuts but not Lula's campaign pledges, estimates a primary deficit equal to 0.6% of gross domestic product, and XP predicts that with extra spending from Lula, the shortfall will expand to 0.9%. Congress would need to approve additional spending, of course, and with plenty of opposition among lawmakers, that's far from a given. Lula also needs to appease bond investors by maintaining a degree of budgetary prudence. With the U.S. Federal Reserve and other major central banks lifting interest rates, borrowing costs are rising globally, adding to the potential expense of debt-fueled spending. And investors have shown they're not shy about punishing fiscal irresponsibility, as demonstrated by the market reaction to former UK Prime Minister Liz Truss's announcement of unfunded tax cuts in September. We will have to understand how they are going to make the social aid and all the other promises happen, says Roberto Siskemski, an economist at Barclays PLC. To spend more, the new government will need lawmakers' blessings to bypass Brazil's most important fiscal buffer, a spending cap that says expenditures can't grow more than the previous year's inflation rate. Lula would need to form alliances with the Centrado, Siskemski says, referring to a group of lawmakers with shifting loyalties who have historically provided votes in exchange for backing for projects in their home districts. Most economists and politicians think the spending cap in its current form is doomed, but exactly what will replace it is unclear. Options include allowing public spending to grow by more than inflation or implementing a budget surplus target. The next economic team will be under pressure to define spending rules quickly, says Seo Mango, chief economist at XP. They will have to signal very clearly that they are moving from point A to point B, and they won't let spending get out of control. Brazil's gross debt stands at around 77% of GDP. That's lower than at the height of the pandemic in 2020, and it could fall a little further by the end of 2022 because of one-off revenue this year. But it's still above pre-COVID levels and higher than that of major regional peers such as Chile and Mexico, meaning it's of potential concern to investors. Lula's victory continues a trend of wins by left-wing candidates in Latin America over the past 18 months, most prominently in Chile, Colombia, and Peru, as voters have punished incumbents who were in charge during the COVID outbreak. Yet, despite his triumph, the president-elect will face a divided country and a divided Congress after the closest presidential contest since Brazil's return to democracy four decades ago. Although Bolsonaro lost, his allies have captured a large presence in both chambers of the legislature, and they control the country's three most populous states, São Paulo, Minas Gerais, and Rio de Janeiro. The election exposed the split between a sizable minority who support Bolsonaro's right-wing policies and those who oppose his views, including predominantly poorer voters with memories of better times under Lula, who oversaw a commodity-fueled economic surge. In addition to the budget, Lula faces broader economic challenges. The central bank has, for the moment, paused its breakneck series of interest rate increases amid an easing of consumer price inflation that's seen the headline rate pull back to about 7% from a peak of more than 12%. But officials warned last month that inflation is still running high and the global outlook remains volatile. Prices of services and other core measures of inflation, which strip out less stable items such as food and energy, are only now starting to slow down, and analysts were concerned about wage pressures even before Lula's victory. A reemergence of inflation risk could prompt renewed tightening, which would add drag to an already slowing local economy. GDP growth is poised to slow to 2.7% this year from 4.8% in 2021, with an expansion of only 0.8% in 2023, according to the median estimates of economists. The global economy is in a precarious place, too. The energy crunch resulting from Russia's invasion of Ukraine continues to harm the prospects for Asia and Europe. In particular, while ongoing COVID-related lockdowns in China and geopolitical strains are denting the outlook for the world's biggest manufacturing hub. That's a worrying sign for major resource producers such as Brazil, the world's second largest exporter of iron ore, though the country could ultimately benefit from supply-related shocks that push up prices for food and crude oil, commodities it produces in abundance, potentially leaving it better placed than many emerging market peers. This article by Martha Vatodi-Beck and Barbara Nascimento. The bottom line, now that Lula's back in charge in Brazil, he has to figure out how to pay for all his campaign promises and keep Latin America's biggest economy expanding. Continuing in economics with inflation fight is now a battle over jobs. Democrats are pressing the Fed to minimize employment losses. In 1994, three unemployed residents of Tucson sued then-President Bill Clinton, seeking to enforce elements of a law Congress had passed 16 years earlier. The 1978 Humphrey-Hawkins Act established a 4% target for the U.S. jobless rate and directed the White House to work in concert with the Federal Reserve to achieve it. Unemployment was 6% at the time the plaintiffs filed their suit. But a provision in the original bill allowed job seekers to sue if they couldn't find work was left out of the final legislation, which is why the judge presiding over the case threw it out. Almost three decades later, the U.S. job market is about the tightest it's been in recent memory, with near-record vacancies and unemployment at 3.5%, a half point below the threshold prescribed in the Humphrey-Hawkins Act. Yet the division of labor the law envisages is coming under scrutiny at a time when inflation is running at its highest level since the early 1980s, and the Biden administration is looking to the Fed to rein it in, even at the cost of putting Americans out of work. The Fed has a primary responsibility to control inflation, President Joe Biden wrote in a newspaper editorial published in May. You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week on Voice Corps. My name is Teresa Darnell, and I will continue with the article. The Fed is rare among central banks for having an employment mandate alongside the more traditional price stability mandate. The former is a byproduct of the civil rights movement, which throughout the 1960s and 70s fought for legislation ensuring adequate employment opportunities for all. The two objectives are widely seen as complementary. The conventional wisdom is that low and stable inflation allows businesses to focus on investment and hiring. But the Fed's balancing act becomes more difficult during bouts of high inflation. At those times, the tendency among policymakers has been to conflate the two mandates in a way that obscures the often painful trade-offs. In February 1981, when inflation was 11.4% and unemployment 7.4%, then-Fed Chair Paul Volcker told the Senate Committee on Banking, Housing, and Urban Affairs he was wholly convinced that, given that the 4% unemployment target couldn't be reached in the short run, the kind of policies we are following offer the best prospects of returning the economy in a time to a course where we can combine as full employment as we can get with price stability. By the end of the following year, unemployment had risen to almost 11%, the highest since the Great Depression. It didn't return to 6%, where it stood when Volcker took office in August 1979, until he stepped down in August 1987. Today, Fed Chair Jerome Powell has a strikingly similar message. At a press conference on November 2, he told reporters that restoring price stability is essential to set the stage for achieving maximum employment and stable prices over the longer run. In September, the central bank published updated quarterly projections showing Fed officials expected it would be necessary to engineer an increase in the unemployment rate to 4.4% by the end of 2023 to bring inflation down to its 2% target. This marked the first time since the Fed began publishing the projections in 2012 that policymakers signaled an increase above the longer-run level they see as consistent with stable prices, which they currently estimate is 4%. If you go to the Fed's statement on longer-run goals, they say that these two goals are typically not in conflict, says Narayana Kachalakota, an economist professor at the University of Rochester and former president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis. Once you have the kind of supply-side shocks that we're experiencing right now, that introduces the conflict. And I think that the Fed, if it's going to stick to 2%, is going to have to endure temporarily high unemployment. Powell, as well as almost everyone else on the central bank's rate-setting Federal Open Market Committee, argues that the labor market is currently too strong and wage growth too high for inflation to return to the low levels that prevailed before the pandemic, despite acknowledging that a lot of today's inflation can be accounted for by supply-side factors resulting from COVID-19 and the war in Ukraine. Since May, the Fed has unleashed a series of unusually large rate hikes, including an increase of 75 basis points on November 2. Over the summer, Powell warned that the aggressive campaign of monetary tightening would bring some pain for businesses and households. Gertrude Schaffner-Goldberg, who chairs the National Jobs for All Network, a full employment advocacy group, says the Fed's approach to cooling inflation by icing demands for workers is misguided, and so is Biden's support for it. This is not the only way to control inflation, and it certainly isn't the way to control a supply-side inflation, she says. Raising interest rates puts the burden of fighting inflation on working people. In fact, the Humphreys-Hawken Act spells out a range of solutions to inflation that don't involve tightening monetary policy, including the establishment of government stockpiles of essential commodities, inducements to collective bargaining, and greater enforcement of antitrust laws to increase competition. Democrats are pursuing some of these alternatives. The White House has released oil from their Strategic Petroleum Reserve in a bid to bring down gasoline prices, and the president's allies in Congress have passed legislation to ease shortages of vital inputs such as microprocessors and minerals used in the production of electric batteries. Meanwhile, with the November 8 midterm elections, Powell is starting to get pushback from Democratic lawmakers worried that the Fed's rapid-fire rate hikes will push the economy into a recession. Sherrod Brown, the U.S. Senator from Ohio, who plays a key role overseeing the Federal Reserve as head of the Banking Committee, sent Powell a letter on October 25 asking him to stay focused on employment as the central bank fights inflation. Colorado Senator John Hickenlooper penned a similar letter on October 27, urging the Fed to pause. For its part, the Fed's willingness to put a number on the labor market damage it foresees as a necessary element of the inflation fight, down to the tenth of a percentage point on the unemployment rate, marks the latest chapter in an extraordinary evolution in the central bank transparency that began in 2012, when it first started publishing the projection and the Fed chair began conducting press conferences after policy meetings. Dartmouth College economist Andrew Levin, who helped design the projections as a special advisor to then-Fed Chair Ben Bernanke, says it's time to overhaul them. Levin says today's inflation isn't rooted in a strong labor market, citing falling real wages as one piece of evidence. But he also argues that the Fed has little choice but to keep tightening, given how far inflation is above its 2% target. In other words, the Fed's employment and inflation mandates are in conflict, and the projections as currently designed, as well as the central bank's messaging around them, don't provide a sense of how monetary policy will seek to balance them under a range of possible scenarios as the inflation fight continues. They need to communicate clearly to the public what may be needed to restore price stability. What are the trade-offs that's going to create, Levin says, and they need to have that conversation with the public and with Congress, with the financial markets, to explain how they're handling the trade-off. This article by Matthew Bosler. The bottom line, Fed officials envision joblessness rising to 4.4% by the end of 2023 as the need to restore price stability collides with the central bank's maximum employment mandate. Moving into technology, HBO and Netflix went to war and remade TV. Streaming television's defining rivalry began with an insult and a sneak attack, an exclusive adaptation from It's Not TV, The Spectacular Rise, Revolution, and Future of HBO. Jeffrey Bukes scanned his mind searching for the perfect war metaphor. It was December 2010. Bukes, the tall, dry-witted CEO of Time Warner Inc., one of the largest, most powerful media conglomerates on the planet, was speaking with the New York Times. The topic, Netflix Inc. On Wall Street and in the media, people were gushing over the disruptive potential of the California upstart. Just recently, Time Warner's top business magazine, Fortune, had named Reed Hastings, the CEO of Netflix, as its business person of the year. Bukes, who had spent the formative years of his career working as an executive at HBO, Time Warner's prized premium cable network, was less taken by the Netflix hype. It's a little bit like, is the Albanian army going to take over the world, he said. I don't think so. The shot at Netflix ricocheted through the industry. Back at HBO, some of the younger managers pored over Bukes' comments with dread. As an executive at HBO, I physically cringed when I read that quote, says Jamin Edis, a former vice president of HBO's Consumer Technology Group. The sheer level of pride and arrogance that would allow our company's leadership to graciously and ignorantly dismiss a competitor out of hand, I knew then that our transformation to a digital company was going to be a bloody campaign. The Albanian rim shot also signals something bigger. A broad realignment of Hollywood power that was already afoot. The whole industry was on a precipice, and the days that legacy media companies could casually dismiss Netflix were about to give way to a new era where they scrambled to mimic its strengths. The defining conflict of this era would pit HBO against Netflix, During the days of DVDs, the relationship was a placid collaboration. But the shift to streaming TV quickly fractured the community, replacing it with a fierce rivalry. In the years to come, Netflix would scramble to master HBO's original programming playbook faster than HBO could reverse engineer Netflix expertise in data and technology. Across the country from Time Warner's East Coast stronghold, Reed Hastings took the Buick's jab in stride. Hastings gathered his top 70 executives for a regularly scheduled business meeting at the Rosewood Sandhill, a sumptuous hotel and retreat studded with olive trees in Menlo Park, California, not far from the Santa Cruz Mountains. Jonathan Friedland, a former communications executive at Netflix, says that at the meeting, Hastings kind of made fun of Buick's, like an NFL coach printing out an insulting quote about his team made by a rival player and then hanging it in the locker room during the run-up to a big game. Hastings used Buick's insult as bulletin board material for the Netflix pep rally. It was part inspiration, part rallying cry. With a quote from Buick's displayed behind him in a PowerPoint slide, Hastings read off fun facts about the military history of Albania to further fire up the members of his squad. That's the kind of thing that was super motivating to people, recalls Cindy Holland, a former Netflix programming executive. As the meeting wrapped up, Hastings handed out a gift to each of his colleagues, army berets, and camouflage green stitched with an image of the double-headed eagle from the Albanian national flag. You're listening to Bloomberg Businessweek on VoiceCorps. My name is Teresa Darnell, and I will continue with the article. Around the same time that Buick's was needling Netflix in public, HBO executives were busy behind the scenes warding off the company's growing incursions. In 2010, Holland and her boss, Netflix Chief Content Officer Ted Sarandos, were on the hunt for more TV2 license for the company's three-year-old streaming service. They were especially interested in premium serialized content, and there was no bigger player than HBO. Netflix subscribers would often request the disc for a season of an HBO show, say, The Sopranos or The Wire, consume them quickly, then request more, finishing every episode before shifting to something else. The serialized storytelling seemed tailor-made for Netflix binging. For years, HBO had been selling lots of DVDs of its famous shows to Netflix and considered it a valued customer. But whenever Netflix executives broached the topic of licensing programming for its streaming service, HBO shot them down. Not easily dissuaded, the Netflix execs kept trying. Sarandos, a huge comedy nerd, was a big fan of Mr. Show, a sketch comedy series that ran on HBO for 3 years in the 1990s, which had grown into a cult classic. It seemed like an easy target. Since going off the air in 1998, the series had been languishing in HBO's vault. Sarandos approached the network executives. Again, HBO rebuffed the offer. In February 2011, an idea for a DC-based drama series, House of Cards, was making the rounds. HBO had decided to scoop up the series and offered to buy it at a pilot level, meaning the producers would shoot an initial episode that HBO would access to decide whether to move ahead with an entire season. But before that could happen, the Albanian army landed a devastating sneak attack. Everywhere HBO looked, the Albanian army was on the march. In January 2012, Netflix premiered its first original series, a show from Norway named Lillehammer. A year later, in early 2013, Netflix took its big swing. Rather than parceling out the first season of House of Cards in chapters, one per week like HBO did every Sunday night, it posted all 13 episodes of the first season at once. In 2013, Netflix became the first streaming service to win a primetime Emmy with House of Cards. In an interview with GQ magazine, Sarandos did little to disguise the state of the streaming network's overarching strategy. He tossed down the gauntlet that would soon become legend in the entertainment business. The goal is to become HBO faster than HBO can become us, he said. In September 2022, Netflix and HBO executives gathered in the Microsoft Theater in downtown Los Angeles for the 74th Emmy Awards. In recent years, much of the intrigue surrounding the annual award show has coalesced around a single recurring question. Who would gobble up more trophies, HBO or Netflix? This year, it was HBO that triumphed. The night's defeat added to a difficult stretch for Netflix, one that had seen its share price plummet as the company lost subscribers over the first half of the year. Even so, Netflix is still on top of the competition with 223 million global subscribers compared with roughly 76 million for HBO and HBO Max. In mid-October, Netflix revealed that it had returned to subscriber growth in the third quarter. During its 50-year history, HBO's programming slate has frequently returned to the theme of succession of rulers, Game of Thrones, talk show host, The Larry Sanders Show, drug dealers, The Wire, media scions, succession. It's always presented as a messy blood sport. The dominant player in any drama rarely gives up power without a fight, and those looking to ascend are not inclined to play nice. In this, the home entertainment industry is not that different from Baltimore's drug industry or the shadowy castles of Westeros. Anyone wanting an eloquent summation of the state of the industry in 2022 could do worse than to rewatch Succession. At the start of the second season, the Roy family's media business is under duress. Too many internal squabbles and too much debt has left it vulnerable to a hostile takeover. Logan Roy, the patriarch, presses his lead banker for a candid assessment of the conglomerate's standing in the market. There's blood in the water. Your price is edging down. Tech is coming. Tech is here. Tech has its hands around your throat, the banker tells him. There's maybe one, two legacy media operations that will make themselves big enough to survive. This article by Felix Gillette and John Goblin. The bottom line, HBO and Netflix's working relationship shifted to an intense rivalry as the rise of streaming inspired each company to reshape itself to be more like the other. Moving to In Brief, we used to have one denialist who lost an election. Now we've got hundreds of them running countrywide. Adrian Fontes, a 52-year-old former U.S. Marine running as a Democrat to be Arizona's Secretary of State, says there is no ignoring what is at stake in the midterm elections on November 8. If you don't call it fascism because you're afraid to offend somebody, you're not doing your job, he told Bloomberg. An anonymous tipster on October 31 began circulating a screenshot of an outline for a reopening plan in China, whose COVID-zero strategy has severely crimped the economy. Officials in Beijing have stayed mum on the rumors, but on November 2, one gauge of stocks in the country had climbed almost 7%. On November 1, BP reported adjusted net quarterly income of $8.15 billion, just below the record it set in the second quarter. U.S. President Joe Biden and U.K. Prime Minister Sunak are both considering windfall taxes on the oil majors. The companies continue to profit from Russia's invasion of Ukraine, which has pushed up energy prices worldwide. That's all for articles from Bloomberg Businessweek. Thank you for listening. Stay tuned for more programming on VoiceCorps, your audio access to the world.